The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. And the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback. Welcome back to Curbsiders Teach Season 5, our series for health professions educators. This is the last episode of our season. We've had so much fun this season, getting amazing guests, and I think this is a perfect wrap-up to it. So I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krishnovskaya. On today's episode, we get to discuss how to mess with theory, educational theory, learning theory, with Drs. Eric Kung and Jimmy Beck. And so, Ira, can you tell us a little bit more about what we do on this podcast?
You got it, Molly. We are the health professions education podcast for all things teaching related. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of educators. And we have a great conversation with our guests, Drs. Hung and Beck. And we cover really how to lower the barrier to entry relative to talking about theory, integrating theory, and really kind of helping your trainees learn, like how to learn effectively. And then occasionally how to do that by bringing in some theory.
We have two great guests tonight. The first is Jimmy Beck. He is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He's an attending in the Division of Pediatric Hospital Medicine and fellowship program director at Seattle Children's Hospital. He's a doctoral learner in the UCSF University Medical Center Utrecht in the health professions education program, where he is studying the positive influence of stress on learning.
And we have Dr. Eric Kung, who's a professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. At UCSF, Dr. Hung is the associate dean for students in the medical school, and prior to that role was the residency program director for psychiatry. He is a member of the UCSF Academy of Medical Educators, and his medical education research is in learner assessment and strategies to optimize the learning environment. His clinical work is in HIV psychiatry and LGBTQ mental health.
And we are excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. A reminder that most of our episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And thank you to all our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content but haven't joined yet, please consider supporting us to continue to create this amazing resource. And as I said, this is our last episode of the season, so we will be taking a break, but I really would encourage you to go back to listen to some of our prior episodes, prior seasons. Such a wealth of knowledge there from so many amazing guests. So without further ado,
let's get to it. Yay!
Hi, Dr. Hung. Thank you so much for joining us today. Are you okay if we call you Eric for this recording?
Yes, totally. Please call me Eric.
Wonderful. Thank you. And similarly, Dr. Jimmy Beck, thank you for joining us. Are you okay if we call you Jimmy today?
Absolutely. Yes.
Perfect. Well, we'd like to just start with some basic rapid fire questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So maybe we can start with you, Jimmy. Could you give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Sure. So I'm a pediatric hospitalist. I'm married to a pediatric hospitalist. Huh? I have two young, amazing daughters. I love college sports, especially college basketball, and good food and good wine.
Amazing. Do you have a favorite food?
Love seafood. Anything seafood.
I was going to say, do you have a favorite basketball team? But Molly got me with the food. Do you have a favorite team, Jimmy, or a team?
Well, I went to Duke.
Huge
Duke.
I went to UVA, so I'm sorry. We're not allowed to, you know, support each other. But that's okay, because, you know, educationally, I support you a lot. But basketball. There is a rumor, though, that Grayson Allen's coming to the Warriors, and I will lobby against it. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But there is a Duke. There is a Duke SF connection. On that note, or not note, Eric, do you mind giving us a one-liner about you?
Sure. So I'm a San Francisco native. I am a psychiatrist by training, and I'm the proud dad of two Basenjis. Basenjis are a really interesting dog breed. They're the smallest hound, and they're known as the barkless dog. So I am trying to chase them as much as I can, and they're just amazing pets.
Wait, so do they not bark?
They don't bark. Yeah, they do make a really interesting yodeling sound, and you can get lost in YouTube rabbit holes of listening to Basenji's yodel, but they actually don't bark.
Wow. That must be so meditative, I feel. I don't know.
Well, meditative is one way to say it. Their yodel sounds like a dying hyena. So
Not exactly.
They are quite noisy when they yodel.
Okay. My dog just snores all the time, so.
Oh, buns.
Yeah, buns. We have an English bulldog, and she definitely has sleep apnea, and we have not found a dog sleep specialist yet, so.
Oh, no. She needs a CPAP machine.
Yes.
Yes. But she needs to go through a sleep study first before she gets that, so it's covered by insurance, you know. Wow. I'm going to have to definitely take that YouTube rabbit hole.
On that note, do you have a favorite movie, show, album that you've listened to lately, something that, or book, anything that you've enjoyed that you'd want to share?
Oh, gosh. Last week I was at the Lady Gaga show in San Francisco, and that was amazing. The album is just spectacular, and her show was out of this world. So definitely have that top of mind. And then I also just binge-watched last weekend a new Netflix series called Nobody Wants This with Kristen Bell. And it was so, so good.
I agree. I love that show. And they were approved for season two. So we're right on track.
I can't wait. October.
Good. Yeah, we got to stretch out the anticipation there. Love that, Eric. Jimmy, do you have a favorite book or movie or album you want to share with the audience?
Well, I just started. So my PhD mentor, Dr. Bridget O'Brien, just suggested a book to me. It's called 10 to 25, The Science of Motivating Young People. And I've only gotten through a couple chapters, but I really enjoyed it. And it ties in a lot of my PhD work around stress and learning. So it's been a great read so far.
Very cool. Is it applying to your children as well, or?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. It's you know, everything I read, I ask myself, okay, how can I apply this to my learners? And how can I apply this to my two young daughters? There's a lot of overlap for sure.
Love that. Well, maybe do we have time, Molly, you think, for one more question? And then before we move on? All right, y'all. Well, in the spirit of kind of constant learning and motivating young people or motivating people of all ages, maybe if you could each tell us about a meaningful advice or feedback that you received during your career and kind of how you use that. Maybe, Eric, do you mind sharing first?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the pieces of advice that I got from one of my mentors early on in my career is to always say yes, which when you're a junior faculty member early in your career, you're like, okay, yeah, I think I can do that. And I will say that mostly has guided me in the right direction. I was very tempted to say no, Ira, when you asked for me to do this podcast, because I've done two different podcast series for the medical school, and I have vowed every single time I've done the series, never, 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 like, do another podcast, because I hate listening to my voice.
Oh.
You know, when you reached out, I was like, Eric, just say no, but my mentor was like, in the back of my mind, I was like, I channel him saying, just say yes, Eric, so I said yes.
Well, thank you to your mentor, and thank you to you for saying yes.
Yes, we are so glad. Yes.
I hate to watch myself, so I've gotten used to listening to my voice because we have to listen a lot to review edits and things, but I can't even watch the video, so I just can't do it.
Sometimes I watch the videos to just watch Molly and Maya's impressions because we both have very, like, expressive faces sometimes, and it's kind of like the yodeling, Eric. It's very similar. You're like, well, I just went down a rabbit hole and watched this. But we're so glad you're here, seriously. Jimmy, do you have a meaningful advice that you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's kind of aligned with what Eric was saying. So, and I'm sure you've heard this sort of phrase, it's a little cliche, but, you know, on your deathbed, you're not going to regret, you know, publishing more papers. You're going to regret not spending more time with your family and friends. And I think it's true, right? Academic work is infinite, but the time with the people we love isn't. And so I think early on in my career, when I heard that, it helped me when a project or when an opportunity presented itself, it helped me to ask, is this a good opportunity and at what cost? And I think it's also made me better at my job as a pediatrician, because when I do say yes to something, I think I'm more present and more focused. and it's for the right reasons. So I think that's, and I'm sure we've all heard that, but I think it's a good piece of advice that I've always remembered.
I appreciate that as I ponder my future.
Ooh, Molly, dangerous.
I know.
But I also love Jimmy and Eric, your advice is kind of like, they're very complimentary. You know, there's times where you say yes, and there's times where you say yes or say no based on kind of, you know, competing demands or like spending time with maybe people outside of work and kind of doing things that are, you're saying yes to like your kind of non-professional life, you know, as opposed to potentially saying yes also to a professional opportunity that might give you more time for your personal life. So it's like really complimentary advice. Really like that.
Yes. Well, Ira, do you want to move us into a case from Cashlock Memorial?
Of course. Thanks, Molly. All right, y'all. Well, we have a case from Cashlock Memorial. This is Michelle. She is in the educational leadership team of a health professions training program, and they just got an influx of teachers who were previously very heavy clinically. And Michelle is a developing educator herself, and she really wants to make sure she can role model and also teach best practices for these heavy clinicians who are turning into educators so that they can, you know, teach the trainees in their program. And Michelle wonders, you know, she's organizing faculty development sessions for these clinicians, how to really integrate learning theory or educational theory into her teaching. And she also wonders how to advise new, you know, teachers, these clinicians who were previously very heavy clinically and now are coming into their educational identity, how they should actually use theory when they teach themselves, like when they teach their learners or trainees in the program. So, you know, Jimmy and Eric, to start off with some basic definitions, you know, what is theory? What is Michelle even talking about? What is educational theory? And especially in the context of kind of health professions, education, how do we really think about it? And maybe, Eric, we can turn to you first and kind of start the definition parade, we'll say.
Sure. Happy to. I will say that I am certainly not like an expert in educational theory, and I've really come to appreciate it and value it and lean into it over the years that I've been a clinician educator, an education leader at the university that I'm at, which is University of California at San Francisco. You know, to me, I think trying to just boil it down to like the basics is often really helpful. And I like to think of educational theory as just a way of trying to understand the world and understand people. And also more specifically for educational theory, understand how the learning process works. I think we're all really interested in being the best teachers that we can to our students and to our residents and to our fellows and to our fellow faculty members. And educational theory is, I think, sometimes a fancy way to say, how do we know what we're doing is effective and what's some of the basis behind that? And how do we be rigorous and systematic and comprehensive in what we do?
Love that, Eric. Thank you for making it kind of like real and grounding us. Jimmy, do you have anything that you'd like to add and kind of how you think about defining educational theory?
Yeah, I mean, I think even to take a step back, I think thinking about the difference between teaching and learning, because they aren't the same thing. I just came back from the annual Pediatric Hospital Medicine Conference, and I saw a lot of really polished speakers giving teaching sessions. And I think they did a lot of teaching, but I didn't think a lot of learning occurred. So I really try to focus on how can theories help us design those environments, design those interactions and experiences that truly foster learning and not just check the box of, yes, having taught. So I think it's a little semantic-y, but I think I really try to distinguish, and my focus is always, how can I do things to foster learning? And I focus less on what am I doing as a teacher?
I love that, because I think in the end, hopefully our goal is that our learners learn. And so being able to do that effectively is huge. And that's what we really wanted to kind of focus the meat of our conversation on today, is how big of or a small role should this learning theory really or educational theory play in helping us teach as teachers? So maybe kind of big picture, how do you both think about the integration of educational theory and clinical teaching? Is it possible to be a great clinical teacher or educator without knowing any formal educational theory, and why or why not? And maybe, Eric, we could start with you.
I definitely think it's possible to be a really great teacher without knowing much educational theory. And I will also say that it is, I think, a really amazing and great teacher that is able to appreciate how to toggle back and forth between making things real, like you were saying before, and also tying it back to theories about how learners learn and how we can think about constructing positive environments that facilitate that process. I think that in some ways, great teachers become great because they have really great role models and they emulate those role models. And sometimes you don't necessarily need to understand the theory to say, you know what, that teacher was a really effective teacher for me, and I just want to be like that person and do it like that person. And that application can go a long way. And I would also say that educational theory, when we think about different ways of approaching situations or new ways to approach situations, educational theory can really help guide us in thinking about, okay, I'm taking this approach because this is the roadmap that helps guide me in thinking that this approach actually could be effective in this particular kind of situation.
I'm glad you said that. Yeah, because I think, you know, when I went into teaching, it was, I had very little training around education, and it was exactly that. It was, you know, who did I want to emulate and who had I seen? And I think I've grown a lot as an educator, being able to learn some of that background and some of that theory. But so, yeah, I think there's a balance. Jimmy, what do you think about that?
So I'm a huge sports guy, as I said, love sports analogies. So I'm thinking about some of the GOATs, right? So Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods, Simone Biles, Grayson Allen.
No, he came into the conversation again.
And I think, you know, they probably would have been great without their coaches, without Coach K. But I think, and this, I think it applies to med ed folks. I think if you have that formal educational theory, it can make you go from great to greater. So it's not, you don't have to, but I feel that if you have that foundational knowledge, it can only make you a more effective educator. But I certainly know a lot of, you know, thinking about when I was a med student and a resident and fellow, I think about some of my best attendings. They didn't have masters or PhDs. They were still great. But I can only imagine if they had gone through that training, they would have been even more spectacular, in my humble opinion.
I guess I wonder, I'd love to hear from each of you, maybe an example where maybe you went from great to greater, potentially using educational theory, or, you know, maybe you read the book, How Learning Works, to your point, Jimmy, earlier, and you were like, this is how it works. And let me like share it and kind of integrate it. I would love to hear examples, you know, maybe real life examples where you felt like, when I use this educational theory, I taught effectively and really learning happened. And maybe, Jimmy, if you have an example, we could start with you and then love to hear from Eric as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of the concept of desirable difficulties, right? Coined by a psychologist, Dr. Bjork from UCLA. And I think it gets at the concept of short-term pain for long-term gain. And I think one of the teaching challenges that I constantly run into is when to step in to support a struggling learner, when to let them flail a little bit. And because I think that the idea of making learning a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit challenging, actually makes things stick a little bit better. And so now I've tried to intentionally introduce a little bit of friction, a little bit of uncomfort or discomfort. Instead of always giving them the answer, making them go look it up. And I'm sure that they are bemoaning the fact that I just won't tell them what to do. But the act of having to go look it up and then apply it to a patient, I feel it helps it make things stick a little bit better. So that's one of my favorite sort of theories, if you will.
I love that. Desirable difficulties. Locked in. Eric, do you have one that, an example where you have seen kind of educational theory really work into your teaching practice, or maybe even work through a teaching challenge?
Yeah, I do. And before perhaps diving into one of my reflections around that, I will say that the first time I met Jimmy, we've only met just once in person, in passing during the doctoral week at UCSF. And Jimmy's mentor, Bridget O'Brien, said, you have to meet up with, you know, one of my mentees. He's amazing, and he's really interested in stress and learning. And I know that you guys would make this great connection. And we had this like really awesome conversation in my office around the role of stress in learning. And I think we both are really interested in Yerkes Dodson law, which is like this old, old, old law that actually wasn't even developed for humans, but is this kind of upside down you, if you will. And on the sort of horizontal axis is arousal, and on the sort of vertical axis is learning. And we talk about sort of how do you get to that sort of stretch zone, that zone of proximal development where you're at the top of that upside down U, and how do you create just enough stress to be able to get there, but not too much stress that you shut down the learning process. And it's really fun to be back in a space with Jimmy, and I feel like I'm going to learn so much with him in the podcast today. So Jimmy's super excited to be with you. And to answer your question, Ira, learning theories that have been impactful for me as a teacher. So when I was a resident, I was known as the whiteboard guy. And I would love just being up in front of a whiteboard with students or with fellow residents. I would even do it with patients. And just to be able to take a topic that might be a little bit intimidating or really complex, and to be able just to break it down into its component parts so that you could take the key nuggets or the key pearls that your learners could really walk away with. And at the time, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was, again, kind of, as I shared before, sort of emulating other role models that I thought were good teachers. And lo and behold, cognitive load theory was like very much alive and present in the sort of chalk talks on the whiteboard that I was doing. And what cognitive load theory is really trying to understand, how do we optimize the information that people are absorbing in such a way that they can actually focus on the key aspects of what they should be learning and focusing on? And there are things that are distractors that we try to minimize. That's one of the components of that theory. And there are elements that we really want to sort of elevate or showcase because they're essential to that key sort of learning nugget. And that theory is alive and well in a lot of the teaching that I do, even though back when I was a resident, I had no idea what cognitive load theory was. And now when people say it, I'm like, yes, like another example of cognitive load theory in action.
Amazing. Well, I think that gets us to our next question of, you know, it sounds like you were putting some of those into practice as an early educator without actually knowing the theory. And so if we kind of come back to our case, Michelle, she's a budding educator and she's in leadership, and she wants to make sure she does her best in creating faculty development sessions for these new clinicians that are becoming educators. And so when we think about developing faculty who were previously like heavy clinicians and not as interested in education previously, want them to be the best possible teachers, but appreciate that they only have so much time to take, you know, they're not going to go get their master's, they're not going to go get their PhD. Where should she think about introducing some of these theories? Is it better to just kind of teach the principles of how to give a good chalk talk, or is it better to actually talk about cognitive load theory? And maybe Eric, we can start with you.
So I've thought a lot about faculty development and done a lot of faculty development over my career. And I will say that before even thinking about a session, just to appreciate the fact that if people are showing up for your session, if people are showing up for faculty development, you've won like more than half the battle.
Totally.
I think that you hear about faculty who have really busy lives. And in the case that you shared, Michelle has the fortune of having people who are actually motivated and interested in showing up. And just to acknowledge that if you can get people in the room, don't even worry about your theory. Like, just acknowledge the fact that people are there, and then build on that motivation and enthusiasm to help take them to the next step of where they want to go and where you might be able to offer something to help them go there. And I do think that for some people, they might be really interested in a little bit of the evidence in the background for, well, why does this particular approach work? Mm-hmm. And how do we think about this approach in the context of what we understand from theory? And there's other people that as soon as you say the word educational theory, they're like, I could spend like 20 minutes of my time coming to this. And I like, that's the last thing that I want. I just want like the one or two take-home points of what am I doing well and what could I be considering differently to be a better teacher? So I do think that you have to be cautious sometimes when sharing how theory can inform what you do. But of course, theory informs what we do. And I think for those that are really interested in connecting those dots, you can really help reinforce, I think, more than just a good idea, but a good idea based in some evidence and some research.
I love that you're kind of like, thank you for being here and kind of know your audience. It's almost doing a little bit of a needs assessment of kind of what's, who's in front of you, what's their priority. And I guess both, you know, for Eric and for you, Jimmy, like, do you all have any, are there like low hanging fruits or like most accessible theories? Like maybe it is cognitive load theory, but like, is there something that you're like, generally people, even who kind of might get nauseous around the idea of theory, get, you know, are interested in learning more about XYZ theory? Like, are there some sort of low hanging fruit that we can kind of integrate, or Michelle could integrate potentially?
I think cognitive load theory is a great one, because I think it can translate to tangible, concrete strategies that busy clinicians can implement. I think zone of proximal development is another theory that involves sort of scaffolding and adjusting your level of supervision just to beyond what the learner can do alone. I think Eric talked a little bit about the Yerkes-Dodson law. So there's a lot of overlap between Yerkes-Dodson law and ZPD. But I think those three are good three starting points that I think should resonate with even the busiest clinicians. And I totally agree with what Eric said, right? I think educational theory can be overwhelming, and it can turn people off. And so whatever we can do to kind of lower that barrier to entry is really important.
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, sometimes just the word theory feels like it's really heavy in the room. And one thing that I like to think about as an educator is, yes, like the theory is a really important backdrop, but the theory actually informs something that's much more proximal to what we sort of do as teachers, which is having a really good roadmap, like a conceptual framework for our approach to the learning process. And so theory is kind of like almost two steps removed, right? Like a really good theory informs a particular framework for how we understand a learner and how we understand a specific problem or situation. And that framework is like the roadmap for us. And from that roadmap, then we develop our teaching strategies thinking about how we modulate the environment around us. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about all sorts of different learning theories out there, there are some, and of course, like I'm a psychiatrist, right? So, you know, some quickly come to mind for me. You know, there are some theories that focus a lot on the social interactions that we have, sort of social learning theories. And there's others that focus a lot more sort of internally in cognitive or cognition and how we actually construct knowledge and put information together. And then there's others that are focused much more on the behavioral aspects of sort of how we learn. So, you know, really learning through specific behaviors. And all of those different sort of theories inform different kinds of frameworks that then I think emphasize why a particular kind of approach might be more useful in some circumstances versus others. So for example, like social cognitive theories, and there's a lot of, you know, that's a kind of an umbrella term, and there's many theories underneath that, can really focus on, say, for example, the learning environment and how do our social interactions impact how we absorb information, and that can really help guide us. And I was recently working with Larry Gruppen, who has a framework of the learning environment. So trying to understand what are all of the different components that influence how learners actually appreciate and learn in the environments in which they work and train. And we expanded his previous kind of version and understanding of the learning environment. And in that paper that we were writing together, I asked him, I was like, well, what were the initial theories that actually even had you think about how you decided to construct this learning environment framework to begin with? And his initial framework was really emphasizing sort of two big domains. There's the material domain, which is actually made up of like the physical and virtual spaces that we work and train. And then there's the psychosocial domain, which is made up of the personal and the social and the organizational drivers that impact the learning environment. And while his learning environment framework is just a framework, it's not a theory, it's actually, as a backdrop, influenced by like dozens of theories to put that roadmap together for us. And that roadmap is what is really helpful for us as educators. So it was really interesting because, again, I'm not like an educational theorist, but I love frameworks and I love thinking about how can we simplify the world for this particular problem to try to understand it. And all good frameworks, conceptual frameworks, are influenced by a whole range of different educational theories. And I think in particular in medicine, it is such a social interaction. Like that is the currency in which we work and train. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I think social cognitive theories are very applicable in medicine because they are so much of what we do as clinician educators.
And Eric, just to like take it to its like next conclusion, if the like theories that you were just mentioning, let's say cognitive or cultural, kind of are impacting the learning environment framework, how does that, or can you give an example of how that translates to like an instructional strategy or something, you know, like in your kind of theory, conceptual framework, and then, you know, a learning activity, what would be the next example or the next phase?
Yeah, totally. So I'll just go back to that learning environment framework, if that's okay, just to kind of extend that example. So I'm going to actually just push what I said earlier just a little bit, because one of the things that we expanded on in the framework that we wrote on in this paper was thinking about taking that sort of psychosocial domain, the personal, the social, the organizational, and actually expand it out to the societal. And all of those different components can influence the learning environment. Mm-hmm. And why that framework can be so powerful and so helpful is that when you might be stuck with a learner, when they are either disengaged, frustrated, confused, you might intervene at any one of those different components in the psychosocial domain. So for example, you might really try to understand the personal experiences that those learners or that learner brings to the table and why they may be disengaged, confused, or excited and super enthusiastic, whoever that learner might be, and really trying to acknowledge a person's lived experiences, celebrate their identities, create a space of belonging, and really sort of pull on the personal driver of the learning environment may actually facilitate the learning process. And similarly, you may have a learner who doesn't feel particularly engaged or a sense of belonging because the organization has policies or procedures that actually get in the way of the learning process. And trying to actually acknowledge that if I were to focus as an educator on advocating for change for different kinds of policies or different kinds of procedures, I'll take my favorite example as an associate dean for students. We have an absence policy, right? And that absence policy has all sorts of critiques to it. And does it actually facilitate learning in the classroom? And as an educator, you could focus on an individual, but you could also focus on the organization. Mm-hmm. And so I think that particular framework is really powerful because it gives lots of different levels for us, almost like a socio-ecological roadmap mm-hmm. of where should I intervene? And that's one way that a framework guided by theory behind it can be a really powerful tool as an educator.
Well, Eric, thank you for giving such concrete examples that really drove it home for me. And say Michelle introduced that in one of our sessions with these early educators, and a few of the participants were really enthusiastic about it. They took it all in during the session because Michelle was such a great educator. But then they get out into the clinic or out into the hospital, and how do they balance the cognitive load of trying to remember this framework and apply it with the real-time demands of patient care and supervision?
I think exposing them in short bursts and like basal bolus, like insulin. because again, it can be overwhelming. And I think focusing, like Eric said, on a variety of different theories so that people could say, oh yeah, that doesn't really resonate, doesn't land. Well, that's not my style. But that theory that you just exposed me to really resonates. And so I think about both the cognitive theories, because that's what we all probably learned, right? heuristics, biases, you know, dual process, all the desirable difficulties. Those are all cognitive theories, but I think theories that focus on affective factors are hugely important. I think early on in my career, I was too focused on the cognitive theories, and I think I wasn't as effective as an educator. But, you know, I think the educational alliance that Summer Attilio developed is really important. Self-determination theory, communities of practice, because it gets at the fact that, you know, trust and safety and belonging are just as, if not more important to facilitating learning than all the again, the cognitive theories that we're more familiar with.
Well, I really appreciate what Jimmy just shared there. And, you know, you had given a shout out to the book, How Learning Works. And I remember when I was a teaching scholar and read the first edition of that book, I was just like blown away because the book is really kind of guided by theory and they don't talk a lot about theories up front. They just talk about really good teaching principles that are evidence-based and informed by theory, but the theory kind of is driving those really good teaching principles on feedback and how we construct knowledge. And when I came back to the book, I recognized that, oh gosh, it's now in its second edition. And one of the cool things that the authors did in their second edition was to emphasize, I think, a really important thing, which is the importance of a sense of belonging and inclusivity and identity. And they made that the first chapter of their second edition. And it really speaks to just the importance of really celebrating people for who they are and acknowledging that our learners and our faculty and our staff come from a variety of different backgrounds. And we have to acknowledge those differences in those backgrounds to be effective teachers. And if we skip over that, all of the relational and social aspects of who we are and what we bring to the table, then the learning process may not be as good as we want it to be.
And actually, Eric, I feel like that kind of took the words out of my mouth because I was thinking, you know, how we're all practical people and we love a good practical tip. And I guess I wonder when you think about that first chapter in the second edition, how do you kind of practically make that come to life? You know, when you're, let's say you're out of your chalk talk phase or your whiteboard phase, or maybe you're still in it, who knows?
sometimes,
yeah. Maybe how do you include those theories in the moment? And Jimmy, I'd love to hear from you too, but like I'm thinking about you, Eric, as you kind of just mentioned the power of belonging, which, you know, is amazing. And we want to introduce that. We want to role model that. We want to cultivate that. But how do we practically do that in a teaching session when maybe you only have time for a whiteboard or kind of lecture or mini chalk talk? Like, how do you actually make that happen?
So a lot of different ways and a lot of different strategies depending on the group. And I'm going to say something that's going to seem like totally simple and totally easy, and yet we skip over it all the time in a fast-paced environment of clinical teaching. And that's just to actually go around and ask everyone's name, how they pronounce their name, what pronouns they prefer, and to take the time to do that. You know, sometimes we feel like, oh gosh, I only have 10 minutes and I just want to talk about the dopamine receptor or the Krebs cycle or whatever it is. And we skip over introductions and actually celebrating people for who they are and the fact that they are humans and they are showing up. And I think the more that we can actually acknowledge where people are coming from, and names are sacred and names are powerful and they're a really good place to start, that's a good example that comes out of that chapter of really it celebrate people's identities and backgrounds, because the backgrounds and identities that people bring to the table are going to greatly be interacting with what we think of is, oh gosh, this is what I'm really here to do. No, like what we're really here to do is to actually celebrate the fact that we're in a learning space together. And the first part of that is understanding who we are.
I love that. Jimmy, I don't know if you have any additional like practical tips of, I mean, I don't know if you go around being like, this is the zone of proximal development. And like, we are now in that zone, you know, and like name it for people, or like how you really kind of introduce that theory piece when you're teaching.
Kind of to piggyback on Eric's comments. I mean, I think the focus first should be on the learner's experience, not just what you want to teach. And I think getting to know your learners can make you a much more effective educator. Somebody once told me that learners make an impression of you within the first 10 seconds, 10, 15 seconds. And so if you do the things that Eric said, it can go a long way to helping that trust develop, right? If I know a learner, I can push more, I can push harder and get away with it a little bit. And I fully acknowledge that in today's discontinuity of medical education, it's hard to get to know a learner, as opposed to back when I was a trainee, I was on for a month with the same attending, the same senior residence, right? You really got to know one another. It doesn't happen as much. It was easily in 2025. But I think the best educators don't use that as an excuse, right? And I think about the aviation industry, right? When the pilot and co-pilot and flight attendants get together, they got to know each other. They have to know each other within seconds to fly that plane safely. And so I think I try as much as possible not to use the excuse of time as a reason to not get to know my learners as an excuse. Because yeah, there's not a whole heck of a lot of time, but there's always some downtime. And I think the more you can get to know your learners, the more effective your learning can be.
And I'll add to what Jimmy shared. I think that sometimes, you know, we think of teaching, or often we think of teaching when it's done really well as magic, right? Like that just, there was flow there. And if you start to talk too jargony and say, oh, I'm thinking about the zone of proximal development, which, you know, for me means like, where is your stretch zone? If you say zone of proximal development, like no one's going to pay attention to you and they're going to just start rolling their eyes. But if you tell your learners, like, I really want you to be in your stretch zone. Like, I don't want you to be overly safe. And I also don't want you to be overly stressed. I want you to be in that zone of growth and stretch, like bring it down a notch. And I think that that's what the zone of proximal development is. And so I think that the more that we can think about how theory can inform what we do, but then make it, bring it to the people, right? Make it more every day. That's when you really see that magic, you know, come alive. And don't say, oh gosh, this is guided by theory.
But I do love that, because you're translating it essentially. Like in your mind,
yeah,
you have the zone of proximal development, but you're like, and I think this is where Molly and I would love to kind of, for our audience, to really help people who are becoming new educators, or even people who've been so clinically active and just experts in their field, and now they're, you know, starting to teach maybe for the first time. Like, they might not know exactly how to translate that from theory to kind of how I say this to my learners. So you providing that example is huge. And I do wonder if there's other versions of that for people who are starting to be educators, where they can say to their learners, like, you know, I don't want you to be too safe, but I also don't want you to panic. We got to be in the stretch zone. Like, are there other versions of that, maybe for motivational theories, maybe for other kind of effective theories that we should share with the audience, maybe?
Yeah, I'll maybe pick on the book that Jimmy's reading right now by David Yeager, 10 to 25. It's an amazing book. We did it as a book club for our education leaders here at UCSF. And when I first read the book, I was like, ugh, this book is a total ripoff of what we have known in the parenting literature from, you know, decades and decades and decades ago, which is what was replicated by authors like Kim Scott in Radical Candor. And David Yeager uses a very similar framework called the mentor mindset, which is a particular quadrant or zone where we really give learners maximal support, but also we provide sufficient challenge for them. So high support, high challenge. And what that book is, I think, so good about is it really kind of ties in, you know, a lot of different social psychology research into a very relevant and contemporary book that talks about, you know, how do we motivate young individuals? And I would also say that that book applies to adults as well. And how do we think about motivational theory in a way that is a little bit more accessible? And so David Yeager describes this sort of quadrant of the mentor mindset. A really good mentor is someone who provides high support and also high challenge. I would also say that Kim Scott, for those who love the book Radical Candor, she's the author of that book, Radical Candor. Radical Candor is mentor mindset. And so depending on, I think, your audience and what kinds of words and language they use, there's often lots of different ways of having that motivational theory, which forms the backdrop of Kim Scott's book, Radical Candor, and David Yeager's book, 10 to 25, you can sort of think about the language that makes the most sense for your audience.
Anything you want to add there, Jimmy? Or?
Yeah, there's two other somewhat related theories, which I think are referenced in that book that Eric was talking about, but the idea of warm demanders. So this was developed back in the 70s by a psychologist. Her name was Dr. Judith Kleinfeld. She studied the Native Alaska, K through 12 students. And she determined that the most effective teachers were those who are warm, but also demanding. And I think that is something that I strive to do when I'm on service. I try to be warm, provide support, but also to be demanding. And I think the other theory would be...
And can I interrupt you for one second?
Yes, please.
What does that look like? Like, what does it look like practically to be warm and demanding? I guess, I mean, it could be like specific to being a pediatric hospitalist, but like, what does that, you know, in practice actually look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So it's again, showing that you care, that you genuinely care about the professional and personal development of your trainees. It means you're not going to leave people hanging if they need support, but you're also not going to lower the bar or not push because you are afraid of getting in trouble, or you are afraid of pushing someone too far. But you really are thinking about the learner and saying, okay, this person is going to be independently or going to be unsupervised in a couple of years as an attending physician. I need to make sure that they're ready for unsupervised practice. I can't just focus on the patients in front of us right now. I also have to be concerned and worried about their future patients. And so I think that's where the warm, demanding sort of aspects come in. And then the other sort of theory is the challenge support vision framework by DeLaws. It again was developed for adult educators who sort of lived their life for a little bit, but then went back and decided to go back to college. And similarly, the theory or the premise is you want to not only provide that support, but you want to be challenging. You also want to give them that vision of why you're doing the things you're doing, right? Why am I pushing you so hard? And to be really explicit, to articulate the why behind your actions so that they can see, okay, they're doing my supervisor, my teacher, my attending is doing these things, not to be a jerk, but because they want me to be a really great clinician when I am done with my training. And I think both of those theories were referenced in the book 10 to 25, the idea of warm demanders and the Deleuze theory of warm challenge, support and vision.
Amazing. Well, you have taken us through a whole journey of many different theories here today. And I think given some really wonderful examples of how they can really be practically applicable and how educators might share them with their learners, whether subtly or overtly. But to kind of start to wrap it up, if you could give Michelle's new faculty or anyone new to teaching just one guiding principle to hold on to when they approach their new identity as an educator in a clinical or classroom environment, when they're thinking about how theory can fit in, what would that be?
I would say don't be afraid to make a mistake if that's something that's super simple that is advice worth sharing. I think that it's really important for new educators who are excited to teach and want to do more of it to really just put themselves out there and to try different styles and approaches. And when they're curious about learning about different approaches, if they have a mentor that happens to be a really big educational theory geek, go ask them a little bit about what might be informing this particular approach. But don't be afraid to stretch yourself, because there isn't going to be one theory that's going to fit all situations. Theories are only so good as they are the best fit for the problem that they're trying to solve. And we have different problems, and we're going to have and apply different theories because one theory is going to fit a little bit better for this kind of a problem to identify a solution than others. And so I would say and suggest to Michelle, to suggest to her educators, just go out and, you know, do the things that you really enjoy. Pay attention to your learner and center the learner in the process. And don't be afraid to test out and try out new things. It's okay to make mistakes. That's embracing full-heartedly growth mindset.
We love growth mindset on the show. Yes.
Refines and progress.
I know. Carol. Yeah. Carol. That almost sounded like a take-home point, Eric, but don't worry. We'll be back for more of those. Jimmy, do you have one kind of maybe guiding principle that Michelle can hold on to when she's thinking about theory and educator identities?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to talk for an hour about growth mindset because I have very strong opinions about it, but that's probably for another curve. I think just to start with one theory that, I mean, there are thousands out there. And again, to make the entry point or to lower that barrier, just start with one. And there has to be at least one theory that clicks with folks, right? And then maybe start with one, get exposed to others. You can expand your teaching toolbox, if you will. But yeah, just start with one, fix with you. And then, you know, slowly add one or two over the course of a few months or years.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, those did kind of sound like take-home points, but do you have more take-home points that you want to share or should we move on?
We'll always take another take-home point.
You're not limited to two, or
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We're
it's
over
like
two
theories. You can have as many as you want.
Yeah, not to be redundant, but to focus on the learning, not the teaching. I see people winning teaching awards, and if it was up to me, and it's certainly not, but I would reframe things and say, let's call these facilitators of education or learning awards. Right. And I wonder if the same people who won the teaching award would actually win the facilitator of learning. I think in general, the answer is yes. But I think sometimes the answer is no. But really to focus on the learning, you know, what are those sustainable behavior changes as a result of your strategy or intervention? That should be the focus of all this and not just teaching for the sake of teaching.
Love that.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. You know, I often think about the question of, you know, what makes a good teacher? And we ask that question a lot in our faculty development workshops on teaching and learning. And, you know, people will say, well, the person's really nice. You know, they created a warm environment for me. I felt like I was really connected to that person. You know, all of those things are really important. Learner satisfaction is important. Mm-hmm. And if we were only to stop there, I think we would completely miss the boat, right? Sometimes the best teachers are the ones, like Jimmy was saying, they set high expectations, they may have high demands, and they're going to support you along the way, but they're not going to just be nice. And so it's more than just satisfaction, because at the end of the day, a really effective teacher is making that learner push themselves to the next level. And you don't get that always from niceness alone.
I love that. Molly and I are going to strive for the words warm demanders to come in through our evaluations. And if they haven't by next year, we're going to come back to you all and be like, God, what do we do?
Yeah, like our teaching evaluations, if we were to say or see, oh, this person is like a warm demander, like that's like the highest compliment, right? It's not that this person was just warm, which is often what we are preliminarily looking for.
100%. Well, on that note, warm and demanding, we're going to be a little demanding and ask, do you have anything that you'd like to plug? Anything that, you know, Eric, you'd mentioned the paper that you had, you know, with the learning environment or a resource that you'd like to share, a mentee's work, your own work, anything that you'd like to plug?
Oh, gosh, I am the worst at self-promoting, so I'm definitely not going to plug any papers that I'm working on. And I honestly am going to be super, super, super redundant and go back to what we were talking about earlier with this book, 10 to 25. Like I said, like we did this as a book club, and I really resonated with the book. For those that, you know, haven't heard about it, I would definitely say go out and read it. It really informs a lot of our teaching, how we think about motivating individuals, and it's just such a great book to read. So I would just be kind of boringly redundant to say, like, read that book. And if you don't want to read that book, then read Kim Scott's book, Radical Candor.
Jimmy, what about you?
So I would like to put in a plug for the PhD program that I'm in. Let's be real, I would not have been invited had I not been part of this PhD program that has amazing mentors. I want to give a shout out to my primary mentors, Dr. Bridget O'Brien and Dr. Marika Vanshap. They are incredible. And I also want to fully acknowledge that not everyone has the privilege of having the time and money to get a PhD in medical education. I totally get that. But I have grown so much in the few years that I've been part of this amazing program because of the amazing faculty. So if you can do it, and I know it's a big stretch, look into it. I am forever grateful for my mentors, and I'm so glad I had the opportunity to participate in this program.
Thank you both so much. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, this has been really wonderful, and given us a lot to think about, and I think has raised my opinion of educational theory. So thank you.
Not that our opinion is low. We were just like,
how big, but it's small. Even greater. Yeah. Great to greater. Yeah. Exactly.
Great to greater. Not Duke, but anybody else. Except Coach Kate. Do appreciate Coach Kate in the history of coaches. But anyway, thank you all so much.
Well, Ira, that was such a fun conversation. Yes. Any main take-home points that you have or things that you want to take into practice in clinic?
Yeah. I mean, Molly, you know I'm occasionally a nerd for some good theories. I think I definitely want to read the 10 to 25 book that they mentioned and kind of also just think about if I do love some of these theories so much, you know, whether it's cognitive load or self-determination, like how do I translate that into learning, you know, into conversations with learners? Same with the zone of proximal development. Like just, I'm not going to be a total nerd and like name it for learners as we talked about, but maybe just kind of the explanation, having it be just more real and grounded, I think is something I'm going to work on. Obviously, I'm a big fan of belonging. I love using names, make a big deal about that. But I think this is an area where I can stretch, which is to think about how I translate these things with, you know, people I'm teaching or learn or who I'm trying to help their learning. What about you? What are your takeaways?
Yeah, I would say similarly. Yeah, I really appreciated them kind of breaking down that we don't necessarily have to use the academic words to still be able to convey the concepts. And I think theory does influence a lot of how we teach and how we learn, certainly. And so, I think trying to, similarly to you, think about how to integrate some of those theories that do resonate with me, but in a way that's accessible to the audience that I'm working with. And I also love the warm demander. I have a manager that I work with who she is absolutely a warm demander. She's fantastic. And she does such a good job just bringing the team together. And but I've never heard the term warm demander. But as soon as he said that, I was like, that is her. So I will aspire to become a warm demander.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah. Well, this has been another episode of The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for helping make this season possible, and to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at Podpace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoybein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I'm Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment and theory.